Hello, I'm Richard Penson, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you. And thank you for joining us today for the podcast entitled A Wild Type of Approach in the First Line Treatment of HRD Positive Advanced Ovarian Cancer. Today's program is supported by a joint educational grant from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck Sharp & Dohme Co., a subsidiary of Merck & Co. Incorporated. Again, I'm Richard Penson, a physician at Mass General Brigham and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. I'm also one of the IRB chairs at the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center in Boston. And it's my delight to welcome my very good colleague, Dr. Ramez Askander. He is clinical professor of gynecological oncology and the clinical trial office director for oncology at the University of California, San Diego Health and the Rebecca and John Moore Cancer Center, and co-director of the UC San Diego Health International Patient Program in La Jolla, California. Welcome, Ramesh.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. It's such a pleasure to join you today. Thank you for having me.
Good times. Exciting times in oncology. Before we begin, I'd like to repeat our learning objective, which is to evaluate the utility of emerging first-line treatment approaches for HRD positive non-BRCA ovarian cancer. So Ramez, we have a number of maintenance regimens for women with ovarian cancer. Can you give us a high-level overview of your thoughts on maintenance therapy for these women?
Yes, thank you, Richard. So I will say that we've seen an evolution towards what some of us would consider a world of maintenance therapy for ovarian cancer, which historically was not the case that we were accustomed to many years ago. And the maintenance paradigm really was ushered in, I would say, to a large degree after the principal studies with bevacizumab were completed and conducted, showing the benefit of bevacizumab in combination with chemotherapy and then as maintenance. Those are GOG-218 and the ICON-7 trials, suggesting that the incorporation of bevacizumab as a maintenance treatment strategy resulted in a clinically meaningful and statistically significant improvement in the median progression-free survival. But I will say that that was a step in the right direction. And as you and I are aware, there's been a huge transformation in the maintenance treatment opportunities in the frontline setting with the evolution and incorporation of PARP inhibitors. We recall the presentation and publication of SOLO-1, which was led by Dr. Katie Moore and colleagues, which really transformed the paradigm for the treatment of BRCA-mutated advanced stage ovarian cancer patients in the context of a germline BRCA or somatic BRCA mutation, showing a dramatic improvement in progression-free survival, and of course, the landmark 7-year overall survival updated data, all of which strongly support the incorporation of PARP maintenance in this setting for SOLO-1 olaparib in a BRCA-mutated advanced epithelial ovarian cancer patient. But we wanted to look beyond just the BRCA-mutated patient population, and that was subsequently incorporated in alternate studies that looked at maintenance treatment strategies. You know, we can talk more about these in greater detail, but just briefly, for example, the PAOLA-1 clinical trial, which looked at chemotherapy with bevacizumab versus chemotherapy, bevacizumab, and olaparib maintenance. And then we had frontline studies such as PRIMA, which looked at chemotherapy followed by a placebo versus chemotherapy followed by niraparib maintenance. Each of these trials had independent or unique study designs, primary endpoints that were slightly different, patient populations that were a little bit different, and of course, different treatment arms of the trials. But I will summarize by just saying simply that the positive findings of these studies have now allowed us to consider incorporation of niraparib as a maintenance strategy in the front line in patients with ovarian cancer, or the combination of olaparib plus bevacizumab based on the PAOLA-1 clinical trial. And like I said, I think we could spend more time discussing the granularity around each of these studies and the relevance of the data. I will just briefly say that recently, the final overall survival from the PAOLA-1 data was published, and it was provocative, and it was in support of the primary efficacy findings for this combination of olaparib plus bev as a maintenance treatment strategy here in the HRD test positive. And I think that leads us into another question I know that we're going to talk about, which is, you know, what is the relevance of biomarkers in these patients in the context of the trial design, et cetera?
So I love your historical approach. We really have gone from chemo all the time for everyone to through the Rustin data, and it was the least amount of toxic treatment to ensure the maximum progression-free survival, you know, time without cancer. And now with effective therapies introduced as maintenance, as you say, bevacizumab and the PARP inhibitors, we have a wealth of data culminating in overall survival advantages, statistically significant in Paola 1, and in Solo 1, really impressive, massive difference, but too much alpha spend to be statistically significant. So for you in clinic, facing the patient, how do you make those biomarker-driven decisions?
Yeah. So my personal practice is to incorporate biomarker testing in informing how I counsel my patients, how I talk to them about treatment management options. We know that germline testing, and I just want to take a moment to make sure we never lose track of the fact that germline testing is critically important, not just somatic tumor testing, because it has implications for the patient for therapy, but of course, cascade testing to family members who can then have risk-reducing preventative surgery. So I just want to highlight that all of us, I know we're all doing it, but I want to make sure it's done 100% of the time, which is germline testing for BRCA and, of course, beyond BRCA now, understanding the panel of genes that increase the risk of hereditary gynecologic malignancies. Beyond the germline testing, we in clinical practice incorporate somatic testing for every newly diagnosed ovarian cancer patient, epithelial ovarian cancer patient. And what I mean by that is we will look for somatic BRCA alterations. If there is no evidence of somatic alteration, then of course we will do HRD panel testing, and what this is homologous recombination deficiency. And as we're aware, there are different assays that can be used to define HRD, and each of these with a different cutoff, and each of these developed a little bit differently. So we use an assay that's available that looks at loss of heterozygosity, telomeric allelic imbalance, and large-scale transitions, defining a positive score above a 42 or greater. And then subsequently, we also do testing for NGS, tumor testing. And we use the totality of that information to guide our patient-specific counseling. And the reason I bring that up is because what we saw from the Paola 1 clinical trial, what we saw from the PRIMA clinical trial, is there is definitely what we would perceive to be a differential benefit, although the biomarker is not perfect in predicting that response. I will place that qualifier, where we know the BRCA mutated patients have a dramatic benefit, as you alluded to with Solo 1, you know, 70% reduction in the risk of progression or death, hazard ratios that we really haven't seen in ovarian cancer. We see a really meaningful and significant benefit in the HRD test positive population. If you look at the totality of trials looking at PARP inhibitors and HRD test positive patients, the hazard ratio is actually similar. It's around the 0.4 to 0.5 range. So a 50 to 60% reduction in the risk of cancer progression or death. And then we see an attenuation of that in the quote unquote biomarker negative or homologous recombination deficiency test negative population. So we will incorporate these biomarker assessments to help guide counseling, understanding that there does appear to be a more pronounced benefit in the HRD test positive, independent of the BRCA mutated patient population. In the HRD test negative, it's a bit of a more nuanced discussion, as you and I are aware, because of both the magnitude of benefit and then some emerging data about the implications of progression while on a PARP inhibitor.
Yeah, I think so. I think with the voluntary withdrawal of indications for late line therapy, and now for platinum sensitive disease, it's really only for patients who carry a BRCA mutation or have not been treated with a PARP inhibitor before. And so things have changed. Do you think patients understand these magnitude of benefit sort of discussions? Do you have a sort of patient-friendly pitch to help them be involved in those decisions?
It can be overwhelming. God knows I would be overwhelmed if I was seated in front of a physician trying to understand what data results mean. So I think, you know, our job is to be transparent, is to understand the data, but to also understand it in a way that we can deliver the information structured that's digestible to the patient who's sitting in front of us, who may or may not have an understanding in the background of cancer therapy, for example, which are many of our patients.
Yeah.
I personally like the hazard ratio, meaning I don't like just giving a number, but I think that if we just simply utilize a median progression-free survival, we're diluting the message of the benefit for a therapeutic drug. So I like to tell patients, actually, I like to draw it out. And I say, look, over time, the risk is reduced. Now, where in this curve you will land as a specific patient, I don't know. I can't predict that. But I know that over the life of this clinical trial, patients who received this treatment had a reduction in the risk of cancer progression. And so we want to give you the opportunity to have the greatest magnitude of benefit, as you alluded to, for as long as possible, while preserving quality of life, of course.
Yeah, I was impressed. We did an iPad-based study looking at what patients wanted in terms of limited panel or all gene analysis, and patients sort of want everything. So, you know, explaining the absolute magnitude of benefit and relative magnitude of benefit to give them everything, like with Paola 1, you know, the absolute numbers are really impressive, even if you harbor or have inherited a BRCA mutation. One of the exciting things about them this time is that sort of the degree of improvement has really got so good with antiangiogenics and PARP inhibitors that there is hope for the integration of immunotherapeutics. Give us a little background of that and an update about some of the trials that are soon to add to our evidence base.
Of course. Talk about a dynamic time. I will say, as we've talked about frequently, the relevance of immunotherapy and solid tumor therapeutics is clearly evident. The approvals are there. It's dramatic. It's changed the paradigm in terms of taking diseases that were previously incurable and really many times curing these patients, even in the recurrent setting. I will say with humility that in the ovarian cancer space, it's been a little bit more difficult for us to identify a role for immunotherapy, but that's where this theory of combinatorial approaches has emerged to try to augment responses and improve clinical outcomes. So as you alluded to, there are several trials looking at the potential rationale for an immunotherapeutic combinatorial treatment approach. I want to start by DUO-O in the ovarian cancer arena. DUO-O looked at safety and efficacy of standard of care chemotherapy with bevacizumab versus bevacizumab in combination with durvalumab plus olaparib. And the combination approach was really driven by this thought that we can get synergistic responses when we give PARP inhibitors with immunotherapy and antiangiogenic therapy. And I will say that that emerged from a phase two trial, the Mediola trial, which looked at therapeutic efficacy with combination olaparib, durvalumab, and bevacizumab, with the triplet combination showing 24-week disease control 77 versus 28% with the non-triplet combination in Mediola. So this was the premise for the DUO-O trial. Dr. Philip Harder, who we know well, presented the data showing a positive trial. And I will say that it's important for us to think about how the trial was designed. It was a three-arm trial, and the positive report out was in relation to the triplet regimen arm versus the control arm. As we know, there was a separate arm of the trial, which looked at an exclusion of one of the three agents, olaparib component.
Yes.
And that wasn't compared to the third arm. So we have to be thoughtful about the relative contributions as we look at efficacy. But that being said, PFS with the triplet therapy was significantly greater than with bevacizumab monotherapy. 35% of the patients in the triplet arm of this trial experienced some adverse event that led to discontinuation of one or more of the drugs. So that brings up a separate issue, which is as we're incorporating these agents in the front line, how are we going to balance multiple drugs simultaneously as maintenance versus potential treatment-related side effects? Although I think overall tolerability was well received. So that was a positive trial. We'll see what that means in terms of the regulatory implications and the opportunity to potentially have an immunotherapy in the front line.
Yeah.
We also have,
to interrupt, I was going to say, I think what Mediola really taught me was that for recurrent disease, was having the machinery of platinum sensitivity to trigger apoptosis and get the efficacy of combination olaparib durvalumab within the setting when your microenvironment's changed by bevacizumab. And so in the frontline setting, that's our hope for improved cure. So we're going to make immunotherapy work sometime. It's just, it has been challenging, as you say. So what about the other studies where we're going to get more information?
Of course. So we also know that there are additional clinical trials. The next trial is the KEYLINK-001 trial, which I wanted to highlight. KEYLINK is a phase 3 randomized double-blind active and placebo-controlled study looking at pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy with olaparib maintenance for first-line treatment of BRCA non-mutated advanced epithelial ovarian cancer. So here we have a separate immune checkpoint inhibitor, not the durvalumab, but here we're looking at the combination with pembrolizumab and anti-PD-1. We're looking at utilization of olaparib, and we're looking at it in a non-BRCA mutated patient population. We don't know what the results of KEYLINK-001 are going to show. The results are pending, but we eagerly await the findings of this trial because similarly, I will say there are Athena and the first trials. Athena Mono reported out, that was a study looking at maintenance rucaparib, and similar to the PRIMA trial, which we alluded to, which was a positive trial, Athena Mono presented by Dr. Brad Monk and then subsequently allowed us to understand the relevance of rucaparib as a maintenance treatment strategy. It has European Medicine Agency approval. Athena Combo is looking at the combination of nivolumab plus rucaparib. So we're waiting now for Athena Combo to read out. Again, looking at capitalizing on the combination of PARP inhibitor plus immune checkpoint. Again, some of these trials actually layered on anti-angiogenic. Athena did not. And then the first trial, of course, also being conducted in the ovarian cancer space, the ENGOT OV44, or the first study looking at, it's a randomized, again, double-blind, adaptive phase 3 trial, platinum-based therapy with dostarlimab, anti-PD-1, plus niraparib, versus standard of care platinum-based therapy as first-line treatment in patients who have advanced stage, stage 3 or 4, non-mucinous epithelial ovarian cancer. So that's several studies, very similar overall design. Some of them are incorporating anti-angiogenesis, some just PARP and IO, or immune checkpoint inhibitor. But the statistical designs of these studies are going to be nuanced and are, you know, I'm really eager to see how do these trials read out? What are the implications of the statistical design or the study design mean in terms of interpreting the results? And are we going to identify ultimately a space for immunotherapy in the frontline advanced ovarian cancer patient, which we've been eagerly trying to do, but unfortunately to date haven't been able to bring past the finish line?
Yeah. You mentioned Brad and Dr. Monk. I remember when 252 reported at ASCO, and there was a sort of preliminary data, and Dr. Monk predicted that bevacizumab would sort of upset the analysis of intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and he was absolutely right in GOG 252. And so I'm interested, given that you are a great investigator and have had the privilege of leading like GY018, when KEYLINK-001 allows investigator discretion when it comes to such an important drug as bevacizumab, does that worry you in terms of how that might impact the study, the outcomes, and interpretation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's complicated for many reasons. We talk about the potential ability of bevacizumab to dilute, for lack of a better word, the efficacy signal of the IO. Although in these trials, one of the biologic hypotheses is that bevacizumab may help augment the response when it's given in combination, which I think is discrepant a little bit from the 252 paradigm of the intraperitoneal drug delivery approach potentially. The other issue is the PD-L1 status. You know, we've talked about the HRD in the context of response to PARP inhibitor. There's been a lot of dialogue about, well, is PD-L1 expression level relevant to response to immunotherapy in ovarian cancer? We know from Dr. Matulonis's paper, there was a suggestion that PD-L1 10 or greater may select out patients that may respond. We know from Imagine 050, we haven't alluded to that yet, that was presented by Dr. Katie Moore, and that was a Bev and atezolizumab maintenance. That was a negative trial, and they tried to see, you know, explore whether or not there was a relevance there in PD-L1, but it doesn't appear to be the case. So I'm eager to see not just the Bev question, which is relevant to your excellent point, Richard, but also what is the PD-L1 opportunity here? Is there or is there not an ovarian cancer? Does it matter? So that we can really begin to tailor our treatment, if possible.
I thought it was fascinating. In DUO-E, the endometrial equivalent duo, PD-L1 became prognostically and predictively important. So it does make a difference to outcomes, and it really potentially identifies the patients where there's going to be the biggest margin of benefit in that setting where you're putting all of these drugs together. And there, it may well be that that's the same in patients with advanced ovarian cancer. Give us a few expert tips on how you as a team, gynonc, medonc, genetics counselors, nurse practitioners, just given how much information patients need at the beginning as they're starting out in first line therapy, what happens in your clinic?
Such an important and relevant question. The word you used is the word that defines it, which is team. You know, it's very difficult to do this individually. In fact, I would venture to say it's nearly impossible now with the rate in which the data is evolving and incorporating the relevant biomarkers in clinical practice to talk about patients. I'm fortunate in the context of I practice at an institution where I have the ability to have my nurse case manager by my side. We have clinical pharmacists who are part of our practice teams within the cancer center. We have our cancer center geneticists who see patients. And then, of course, we have individuals who help, what I say, the magic happened behind the scenes, sending these assays out, making sure the tissue's sent out, the results come in. You have availability of those results because they're not always integrated in the EMR. So for us, you know, we've actually gone towards a very standardized approach for our ovarian cancer patients. And the reason I say that is it's a situation where you don't ever want to miss a patient. You never want to miss a germline BRCA or a somatic BRCA mutation because we know clearly what that could potentially mean for a patient. We want to know what HRD status is. And we clearly want to make sure that we counsel patients on the implications. So for us, we do all point of care. So we do our, when they come in, first visit for an ovarian cancer diagnosis, we collect their sample for germline testing, as well as HRD testing, and then reflexive comprehensive NGS. It's all done at one time. Mm-hmm. And we did that as a group because we wanted to ensure that that entry point was aligned with this data so that we can inform the patient on therapy and we wouldn't miss a patient. We used to historically refer out, but as you know, and I know, the relevance of genetic testing across solid tumors has exploded. Mm-hmm. So the bandwidth of our cancer center geneticists to see patients, counsel, test, that became a bottleneck. So now when we do this, if there is a germline alteration, then we can have them speak to the genetic counselors as well. So we speak to them and refer them. But if there is no germline, then of course that they can bypass that component. We can look at the tumor-specific alterations, report on these results, incorporate, but it requires a matrix of individuals who are unified and understand the, you know, the shared priority and it, that it integrates with our EMR.
Yeah, beautiful. I'm in the process of moving folate receptor alpha up front as well, because it's been our experience during this last year that with a third of patients having recurrence with platinum-resistant disease, it is too scary to wait for weeks to get an assay back. You want to have that in the bag ready. And we just had a bowling event where we took the team, or our boss took the team, to celebrate the team, because it is a lot of hard work. I was reading the other day of somebody criticizing cafeteria oncology, where it's all generic, you know, slop of potatoes and whatever. But you need a system so that patients don't miss out on things. And then when you have a team, you can add that passion of the individual connection as well.
Yeah, I agree.
When you think about sequencing therapies, in your mind, do you sort of keep immunotherapy in reserve? Do you mention it to patients? Is it something you really are enrolling patients into more in late line therapy? Philosophically, how are you thinking about where immunotherapy is going at the moment?
Yeah, I think in ovarian cancer right now, again, in the front line, we're waiting to see how things evolve. We still don't have an approval for the immunotherapeutic, specifically immune checkpoint inhibitors. I will say that there are clinical trials, like we alluded to already, the results of which are pending, may read out and change our practice. With sequencing, I think we have many effective agents at our fingertips, and it's determining whether or not we use them in combination, whether we sequence them in sequential lines of therapy if patients recur. I will say for me personally, my bias is towards using the most effective combination for the patient at the line of therapy in which I am managing them, rather than saying, well, I'm going to hold on to this agent if I know that the combination is effective. A great example of that, for example, is the HRD test positive Bev plus olaparib. I will use the combination of the PARP plus Bev in that setting rather than hold on to a drug, for example, the Bev, for a later line of treatment because we have established data that Bev after Bev is effective. For immunotherapy, I haven't used immunotherapy in the recurrent setting, certainly. Of course, in the frontline trials when patients were enrolled, we have clinical trials that are looking at immunotherapy options or cell therapy options for ovarian cancer patients. And then just briefly, I'll also highlight that there are NCCN compendium listed regimens that utilize immunotherapy in ovarian cancer, independent of the disease agnostic. So TMB high, DMMR, you know, we need to make sure that clinicians don't ever forget those happen in ovarian cancer. I have a handful of clear cell ovary, DMMR, PMMR with recurrent disease who had a dramatic response to immunotherapy in the recurrent setting. So we must look for those. But independent of those, we have the cyclophosphamide, bevacizumab, pembro combination, which is NCCN compendium listed following the efficacy data that was established from that single arm trial. I'm eager to see more data emerge here driven by our clinical trials to suggest benefit. But as you know, thankfully, we live in a time where there's tremendous interest. Immunotherapies move beyond just the checkpoints. We're looking at combinatorial approaches. We're looking at cell therapy approaches. And so my hope is that we're able to identify through thoughtful study design and also conduct of these studies, treatment opportunities for these patients, both later line and then what maybe moved up earlier in therapy.
Beautiful. So unfortunately, it's time for us to wrap up our discussion, which has been great. So let me summarize what we've discussed today. Some of the new approaches, the better outcomes with antiangiogenics and PARP inhibitors, and now the third and the first study with Duo-O to show a PFS advantage with a combination of durvalumab and olaparib, and lots of new trials reporting as soon as this year. Testing for all is vital, and as Ramesh says, really getting down to the nitty-gritty of the tumor, not just the inherited genome key. And to quote the NCCN guidelines, you know, a clinical trial can be the best option. And so we are indebted to the patients who've gone before, altruistically been involved in practice-changing studies. Thank you, Ramesh. You can find additional information and resources at the CME Outfitters Oncology Hub, with a number of excellent resources for clinicians and patients. To receive CME and CE credit for today's program, complete the post-test and evaluation, and you'll be able to download and print your certificate immediately upon completion. Remember, this is the fifth of a six-part podcast series on gynecologic cancers. Next month, I'll be joined by Jennifer Phillippe to discuss managing adverse events in patients with ovarian cancer receiving immune checkpoint and PARP inhibitors, and I hope you'll be able to join us. You can find additional podcasts in this series on the Oncology Hub at cmeoutfitters.com. And again, thank you, Ramesh, for joining me for this very important discussion. And thank you to our audience for participating and for providing the best of care for our patients with ovarian cancer.
Thank you so much, Richard, for the kind words. Thank you for having me and moderating this discussion. It is an incredibly exciting time.
Exciting times.